The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, also have on the back table, I did this 8 years ago. It's a Hubert Harrison reader, edited and introduced. It's 138 of his writings. We've been able to locate 700 of his writings. This is the father of Harlem radicalism, right? We're putting all 700, not getting paid a penny, but we're putting all 700 on the website of Columbia University's rare book and manuscript library for free worldwide searchable database. We're going to get into Harrison very quickly. I'm an independent working class college, but my focus is on the fight against white supremacy. I'm pretty convinced that white supremacy is a principal retardant to efforts at social change in this country. If we want serious social change, we got to take it on. I'll get into the story in a second, but I inventoried and indexed Harrison's papers, which had been left in an apartment in Harlem, right? So I had intimate familiarity with that. I also have intimate familiarity with a person who's kind of like a mentor to me, another independent working class anti-white supremacist scholar. You may not be familiar with him. We'll get to him in a second. Theodore W. Allen. This is a pamphlet, it's a pamphlet form, but it's available for free. I'm going to give you my website in a second. A lot that I'm talking about is free online. You can just access it. He wrote two volumes for Verso in the 1990s on the invention of the white race. Very important stuff, and he'll come into the conversation at different points. So with that said, all right, there's the webpage. It's got 70 Harrison articles, all kinds of reference, all kinds of links. It's got Allen. It's free. If you remember my name, Jeffrey B. Perry at Gmail, you can get in touch with me. I would appreciate. Oh, another thing I got to say, besides the books being sold out, in 7 months we've done about 70 slide presentations, book talks. Any place we can go, we're taking it. We're not looking for a penny. I got the postal pension and the union pension. I'm happy. I live modestly. I guess you can tell, right? So, all right. So, here we go. Okay. This, and I know ISO, I applaud the work, all the young, the student chapters and everything like that. But we're opening up with a Harrison. This is 1919 message to the youth. And basically, he's saying develop critical, independent thought, right? That's what that's about. You can read it. Set it before yourself. Second duty: always surpass your teacher. Never bow the knee to Baal. Respect wrong. Read, reason, and think on all sides. Don't think you know until you've confronted 10 contrasting views. All right, next one. Who was Hubert Harrison? He lives from 1883 to 1927. This is only volume one. This ends in 1918. It's got a lot in here. But the second volume is going to be a monster. It's Harrison with the socialists, again, still. Harrison with the communists, Harrison with the Garvey movement, and 400, 500 of his major writings. It's in the period of the 20s in Harlem, right? So that's going to be a major book. And a lot of it's done, but be a few years still. He was a brilliant writer, orator, educator, critic, and political activist. He is arguably, and I don't make this statement lightly, the most extraordinary black intellectual activist of the early 20th century. Next one. His scrapbooks. In 1982, I set out, years ago, I was working in the post office. I was actually, after we got fired from strike, some of us got back. I was the elected head of a 4,000 worker facility in Jersey City, and I was doing that full time. But I was also going back to school because I was interested in, reading, studies, analyzing. And I was addressing a problem which you all probably have thought about in many ways, but I was looking at all the left, from the early part of the 20th century all the way through, left organizations, how they had approached what is variously called the race national question, right? Because I wanted to see. And I was looking at everybody. I was pretty familiar with everybody's things. And I'm a serious primary researcher. I mean, I have 400 or 500 archival boxes of stuff at home and 6,000 books. It's a serious effort over the years, right? A lot of collections. In terms of Harrison, I came across a few references to him. J.A. Rogers, Richard B. Moore, Philip S. Foner had written a little bit. There were some early historians, a fellow named Wilfred Samuels had written. Ernie Allen teaches at UMass Boston, but there wasn't too much. But what I saw interested me, so I looked for his two books on microfilm in the Schomburg Center, a big public library in New York. And he has two books, When Africa Awakes in 1920 and Negro Nation 1917. I got the books on microfilm, I printed copies, I read them, and I was arrested. I had never seen such clarity. I'm familiar with the literature of the period, right? And I said, wow, I'm not the only one who's had this reaction. A fine historian, Winston James, some of you may be familiar with him. He's written Holding Aloft the Banner of Ethiopia about early 20th century Caribbean radicalism. He was at Columbia, he's now at UCal. We talked again yesterday, and he had the exact same reaction. He goes, Jeff, this is a no-brainer. He's head and shoulders above his contemporaries. All right. So I started writing on Harrison. I dropped everything. I had 300 pages. I was able to track down his family. The son was living in an apartment in Harlem, 150th Street off Bradhurst, right? And in the front room of that apartment, they had just kept all Harrison's papers since 1927 when he died. This was in 1982. I came to take these papers. So what I did, and somebody might be in the same situation yourself, so I'm doing this very quickly, but I spent a few thousand dollars, I got Mylar, I got acid-free paper, archival boxes, because I knew my first responsibility was to preserve this material, which is what I did. Subsequently, in 2005, Harrison's papers were sold to Columbia's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. They're available, free to the public. There's a 102-page finding aid, which is basically what I had done over the years, right? And then they put it onto their thing. It's available free online at my website or at Columbia's thing, so you can see all his papers. And the family got $250,000 for those papers. No money, no rip-off, right? I don't think that's to them. So that's where it is. So these are some samples of Harrison's scrapbooks, how he kept his stuff, right? And we'll get in very quickly, but I just wanted to show you some documents. Glenn, we'll go. There's the reader. This is his grandson, granddaughter, great-granddaughter, and great-great-granddaughter when the papers were placed at Columbia, and the woman who was the archivist at Columbia. Okay, Harrison, race-conscious, class-conscious. Last thing, when I started writing on Harrison, I mentioned a few places I could find information, but in general, he was not even covered in the history. A lot of the academic histories, they would do in half a sentence, Hubert Harrison, the black nationalist, Hubert Harrison, the black socialist. The looting was done, that was how he was done. It's interesting that he self-defines himself as a radical internationalist, and we'll get back to that later. All right, next one. Okay, this is Joel A. Rogers. People may be familiar, a great independent historian, Pullman Porter, Jamaica-born, wrote many books. What I'm going to refer to right here is his book, World's Great Men of Color, two volumes, 1946-47. He writes on Hubert Harrison, amidst chapters on Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Garvey, and William Monroe Trotter, that Harrison was the foremost Afro-American intellect of his time and the one with the sanest program. That's what Rogers says. All right. Here's Harrison, 1926, teaching a course on world's problems of race. This is in the building of the Urban League, but I believe this course was teaching it for the Worker School, which was the Communist Party school. He was not in the party, but he was teaching their courses. He was in the ANLC, but he kind of by that time was maintaining his independence. 74 people here. These are many of the outstanding black activists, the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Just to name a few, to the left, far left is Richard B. Moore, Socialist Party, Communist Party, African Blood Brotherhood. Frederick Douglass bookstore he ran in Harlem for many years, one of the leading Scottsboro orators. Next to him is W.A. Domingos, socialist, becomes first editor of Marcus Garvey's Negro World, goes back to Jamaica, and is instrumental with the Manley family, you know, when it's the beginning of, you know, the some of that independence movement. Williana Jones Burroughs, we're going to talk about her more in the front, a school teacher and activist in New York. Hermie Weisswood, the book came out recently, Caribbean Crusaders of the Harlem Renaissance by Joyce Moore Turner, features Hermie Weisswood a lot. She's from Guyana, and many other people. And this is Harrison on World Problems of Race. Next one. All right. As an intellectual, we're opening up. Rogers says he's the foremost intellectual. He comes in 1900 as a 17-year-old orphan. He works 5 days a week, three nights a week. Goes to school the other two nights. He gets citywide honors in three subjects, Latin, history. And the headline of one of the New York dailies is Genius Found in West Indian Pupil. They had never seen it. Write about our autodidacts. They're self-educated. Harrison never went a day to college. Allen went one day and left because he found it too confining. They are working class, anti-capitalist, so Harrison, his last language that he was teaching himself was Arabic. Not because he was religious, because he wasn't. We turned to science much earlier, but and he was reading the Quran because it was the religion of so many people of African descent worldwide. He read voraciously. When he died, the obituaries, two of them, ran that he reportedly read 6 books a day. I've been through his papers. He knew how to attack books, and he read voraciously, but I think he knew how to attack books, so he's not reading them page by page. As an orator, he was considered unrivaled. I'll show you a quote. Well, many of his contemporaries said that. He was unrivaled. He was the pioneering soapbox orator in Harlem. He is the one who started the tradition, continued by Malcolm, Martin, Garvey, Randolph, not Martin, Randolph, Owen, Garvey, Malcolm, and many others. And he spoke on a great variety of subjects: history, science, politics, education, literature, theater and evolution. Speaks on the street corners in Harlem on evolution. He also spoke Wall Street, 1913, for 3 hours on the need for socialism in front of the stock exchange, to a rapt three hours the crowd, and other times he's speaking on the street corners, 1500, reported by the New York Times, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, he's a prolific writer. I indicated 6 to 7. You got to ask at some point in his presentation, why haven't we heard about this guy, right? When he's starting out, he's an editor for a while of the not the principal editor, but the Masses, a premier left literary publication, decade between 1920, the early period. He edits The Voice. That's his paper. That's the first newspaper of the New Negro Movement, which he is really the pioneering figure in, right? He edits The New Negro. Now, this is done in 1917. This one he edits in 1919. Now, people take history courses and they hear about The New Negro and they're told about Alain Locke in 1925, mm-hmm. a literary arts-based mm-hmm. movement. This stuff starts a decade early in social political activism. And Harrison is a brilliant writer. Every paper he edits, though, has poetry for the people and book review sections. He's literary as could be also, right? He lectures for the Board of Education and colleges and stuff on literary trends of the times and things. So he's extremely literary. But one thing just very quickly here, and we'll go into other things. Again, just in terms of people getting introduced to black history. When they're told about early 20th century, right away you're told about the big debate between Booker T, Washington, right, and Du Bois. That's how a lot of it gets framed. Harrison, the toothpaste is out of the tube on this one. Harrison's entering the picture. And he is the new radical working class voice, the immigrant voice, the Caribbean voice. It's a whole new dimensions coming into the debate and discussion. Okay, as a critic, he's a brilliant critic. We've been able to track down 68 to 70 book or theater reviews he did. Eugene O'Neill, after his review of The Emperor Jones, which was done, the first edition was done by Charles Gilpin, the leading black actor of the day. Later, Robeson did it. Eugene O'Neill, who wins the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1934, writes to Harrison after Richard. Well, of course, I don't imagine black literature. As I said, we got 68 to 70. Okay, go on. All right, continuing on the black intellectual. We're still on him as an intellectual overview. We're not getting into all of his life yet. He is the pioneer black activist in the socialist movement. We're going to get into this deeply. He's the leading black in the Socialist Party. He is the leading black activist in the free thought movement. We'll talk about that, but that's a movement. Free thought, unfettered from religion, turned to science, right? He is a pioneer black activist in the birth control movement. The first one that I've been able to identify, you know, you get wary of first this, first that. But he's speaking on street corners in New York City in 1914 and 15. And when the cop, you know, winks and looks the other way and the gang of unruly whites attack him, he has to take the table leg to defend himself. This is on 181st and Broadway up in Washington Heights, right? He's a promoter and aide to black writers and artists. He very much understood the interrelation of arts and politics. So Claude McKay, Augustus Savage, leading black sculptor of the period, U.B. Blake, musician, Charles Gilpin, the actor, J.A. Rogers, all these people Harrison's supporting, you know, encouraging and working with, and they all appreciate and they all comment on him. He's a featured lecturer for the New York City Board of Education from 22 to 26. When those lectures at night were a principal form of adult education for people in the city. He was a bibliophile and library popularizer. He collected books, he sold books on the street corner. He and Arthur Schomburg were two of the four members of the founding committee of the Schomburg Center, which is the premier library for research and black studies in the US. It's on 135th Street in Harlem. He and Schomburg, two of the four founding members, they each donated books. Schomburg donated more books, had more. Harrison would lecture every Wednesday, people would be coming in, you know, drawing the crowd in, because he was a big proponent of free public libraries. Read, read, read. Again, he really wanted to encourage people to develop independent, critical things. We'll go on. We'll pick up some more of these. There's O'Neill's quote. Next one. Henry Miller. Henry Miller was the autobiographical novelist, big in the 60s. Was a socialist in his youth. He saw Harrison speaking in Madison Square around 23rd Street. Goes on for paragraphs in the second volume of his trilogy about what a great, unrivaled orator Harrison is. A. Philip, now we're going to go. That's overview of Harrison as an intellectual. Now we're going to talk about Harrison as a radical. This is A. Philip Randolph, 1963 at the March on Washington movement. A. Philip Randolph calls Harrison the father of Harlem radicalism. Next one, go ahead. Harrison is the only person to play unique signal roles in the largest class radical movement and the largest race radical movement of his era, and some historians say up till that time in U.S. history. He was the foremost black organizer, agitator, and theoretician in the Socialist Party of New York during its 1912 heyday. He founded the first organization, the Liberty League, and the first newspaper, The Voice of the New Negro Movement, in 1917. And in 1920, the race radicalism is generally considered the New Negro / Garvey Movement, right? He becomes the principal editor of the Garvey Movement 6 years before Alain Locke. The Women of Our Race, if you can't see this, Education in West Africa, The White War and the Colored Races to Negro Radicalism. So it's a wide breadth of things that he's discussing. Okay, he profoundly influenced a generation of new Negro militants and common people. And I will emphasize this repeatedly. Harrison was of the common people. He is not an aloof aristocrat. When he lives in New York, he first lives on 62nd Street in a five-block stretch with 3,500 people. He moves and settles at 231 West 134th Street in Harlem, most densely populated block in the community. He's out amongst the community all the time. And his rights, and he writes essays on the common people, not, you know, affectionately, you know. And I've described him in both books, to give you, you know, a little characterization, as the most class conscious of the race radicals of his day, the most race conscious of the class radicals. He's a major radical influence on A. Philip Randolph, who was considered an outstanding class radical. Marcus Garvey, race radical. When I grew up in the 1960s, flip. That's Malcolm, and we continue those lines of descent, right? Flip. All right, he's a key ideological link in the two wings of the civil rights black liberation struggle. Flip. Again, he's also, besides that, extremely knowledgeable on Africa, Asia, Mideast, Americas, and Europe. He lectures on China, he lectures on Japan, he lectures on India, we'll come back. He writes on Africa. I've had Indian graduate students today studying here in the States say the pieces they read from Harrison on India are the best they've seen by any of his contemporaries. Winston James comments in his work and personally about how Harrison not only knew more about Africa than his contemporaries, but he didn't bring that arrogance that so often comes with people from this country. So he really is extraordinary in that sense. He starts in the Negro World. He starts the West Indian News Notes. He's writing all these, you know, wonderful things. All right. His approach, these are some basics of his approach. He is race conscious. He is class conscious. He is scientific. He is internationalist. He emphasizes the common people. A mass approach. He's constantly reaching the masses. The principal means of his day, this is pre-TV. Radio was only in its infancy. He does do a couple radio talks. But the principal means of getting out there amongst the people, soapbox oratory and newspapers, and he's a champion at each, right? He's a big proponent of direct action mass struggle, proactive approach. He understands the interrelation literature and the arts. He's anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, challenged white supremacy, understands it's central to capitalist rule in the U.S. Next. Hodge Kiernan from Montserrat, another very bright, radical, free-thinking black activist of that period, edited a publication called The Promoter in 1920, did many other things. Also a great, artistically a great photo if you check the angle. it's a stunning photo, it really is. And he writes correctly that Harrison lived with and amongst his people, not on the fringes of their social life. Arthur Schomburg was the man most instrumental in building the Schomburg Center, that premier research library in black studies, Afro-Boricua. He's from Puerto Rico. His mom's actually from St. Croix, which is where Harrison's from. But Schomburg also said at the funeral when he delivered the eulogy, Harrison was ahead of his time. And he was. He was very relevant in his day, but he was ahead of his time, and that's why I think he's got much to offer us today. Right. As a thinker, I know ISO pays particular attention to democracy. I think that's an issue, right? And Scott, who I think appreciates this, and I just want to mention Scott McLemy speaking on James on Sunday, right? I'm not going to be here, but I would encourage people to attend his presentation. Yeah. In the epigraph of the book, I went back and forth, what do you want to do? I wound up with a little quote from Roger about how important Harrison is, but I went with a couple of quotes from Harrison on democracy because I think they're important. And I talk about how Harrison as a thinker understood the twofold character of democracy in America. I'll give you a little background. I don't do this at all the talks. August 24th, 1867, Capital is at the printer, right? Capital is at the printer. Marx writes to Engels. This is a big, you know, this is a heavy book, right? And Marx writes to Engels. He goes, yeah, I know, I'm paraphrasing. He goes, I know this is a pretty heavy book. but he says, you know, it's got some basic concepts which I introduce at the beginning. Number one, the twofold character of labor as use value and exchange value. And it just struck me when somebody, you know, writes this complex stuff but understands it well, how they can break it down, they can, you know, understand all that. I think Harrison does that with democracy. So, 1911, when he's in the Socialist Party, he writes, politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. Now, I had to look up the word touchstone. A touchstone is a black stone, you rub it against gold to test the purity of gold. A wonderful choice of words. He's writing this when lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement mar the land, right? Wonderful, wonderful choice of words. He goes on, I paraphrase slightly, but true democracy and equality for Negroes implies a revolution startling to even think of. I think that foreshadows what we saw in the 60s and the catalytic effect of the civil rights, black liberation struggle, how it gave impetus and energy, anti-war movement, student movement, women's movement, and so on, you know, and so forth. This next one, and there's many more, and I have only a few there. As long as the color line exists, again, he's writing segregation, lynching, as long as the color line exists, the cant of democracy. Now, a cant is an insincere, repetitive chant. That's what a cant is, right? The cant of democracy is dust in the eyes of white voters. That concept gets picked up by Du Bois in 1935 when he writes Black Reconstruction, and he talks about the American blind spot. Gets picked up by Allen, the fellow I mentioned earlier, when he writes in the 60s, influences SDS, the student movement a lot, about the white blind spot. Last quote for now was written by Harrison after World War I, but it could have been written 5 months ago when George W. Bush was the president. Woodrow Wilson had, you know, urged everyone to go into World War I to make the world safe for democracy. That was Bush's second reason, I think. It was weapons of mass destruction, and he was going to bring democracy. So Harrison writes, during the war, the idea of democracy was widely advertised mainly as a convenient camouflage behind which competing imperialists masked their sordid aims. Those who saw going and genuine in this country, it hits at white supremacy, and it, you know, really is an impetus for much, and you know, stimulates a lot of change. And, okay, here's Harrison's unmarked shared plot in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Now I get into the story. That was first the intro. I use that picture to symbolize two things right away. One, the poverty he lived in, and he lived in total poverty, as did Allen, the other autodidact that I write about. And also it shows the lack of recognition that he has received. Although that is beginning, as I indicated, it's starting to change. We had just about 2 weeks ago, Charles Barron, a kind of militant council member in New York City, had a proclamation passed. We had a big meeting up at a church on 126th Street. We had two great meetings within 4 days, on 126th and 136th. Second one was with the ISO student chapters in Uptown Branch. And so the proclamation was passed, so it's the beginning. I think there's going to maybe be a move to commemorate his site. We'll see. All right, his unremembrance. This I'm doing briefly, and there is much more to this. But why is it that you don't know about Harrison? The first five reasons And if he was a woman, I would add that are all categories that are underrepresented historically in you know history writing in this country and the world. He's poor, he's working class, black, foreign born, and Caribbean. I would before we flip, I would emphasize you go back and look at each one and just give a pause to think because it really hits me even more you know when you take them each individually. But those immediately jump out. Next. Probably most important, he is a radical. He is a real radical on class, race, and religion. We're going to get into that. Next, he is a forthright critic, and I'm going to talk, and I want to emphasize how he was nurtured intellectually, and he was a very forthright critic. He came with his criticism straightforward, right? Very principled, not mean-spirited. But that burned a lot of people who weren't used to dealing with that, and they punished them for it. He had no long-lasting organizational ties. Although he was active with the Socialist Party after he left with them, he no longer maintained long-lasting ties. So he didn't have an organization that would promote his name and image after he dies. He dies young at age 44 of appendicitis in Bellevue Hospital in New York. He's not martyred like Martin and Malcolm, and he doesn't live another 50 years like Du Bois, right? So, all right. When I say he's a forthright critic, this is just a sampling of some of the people. And of course he's challenging Taft and Wilson and Roosevelt, you know, all the big leaders and Carnegie. But on the left, labor, black sectors, people who you would have think would have done something to preserve his memory, these are people who he criticized openly and none of them did a thing ever to, you know, preserve his memory. Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Garvey, Chandler, Owen, Charles W. Anderson was a leading black Republican. This is only a sample, too. Leading people in the Socialist Party, Spingarn, who's both in the Socialist Party and the chairman of the NAACP, we'll talk about him considerably later, Samuel Gompers, the head of the AFL, William Foster, the head of the CP, Carl Van Vechten, and just a little sampling down below of organizations, probably familiar, the AFL, Socialist Party, Communist Party, Urban League, NAACP, Amsterdam News, Black Weekly, New York, New Review, Socialist Publication, Nation. I get my shot in at the Nation every chance I can. December 22nd, they did a five-page book review on Robert C. Weaver. They haven't said a word about Hubert Harrison yet. All right, now we're going to talk about Harrison. We're going to talk about his Prussian roots. He's from St. Croix in the Danish West Indies. Capitalist agriculture, sugar production, slavery. It's a colony, only 475 out of 23,000 people on the island have the vote. African customs, I talk a lot about this in that first chapter, we're gonna move swiftly, but Harrison emphasizes how certain African customs mitigated the oppression of the plantation life. Very good stuff. All right. Very important, when I tried to go back and look at St. Croix and say what's important in understanding what he later becomes, one of the things that struck me immediately was the Crucian people's history of direct action mass struggle. They have an 1848 enslaved-led emancipation victory. Second place in the Americas behind Saint Domingue, behind Haiti, which C.L.R. James writes about, where it was enslaved-led and for actually many similar reasons, which I'll talk about in a second. All right, Boudot is the legendary leader. 1878, and I try to pay much attention to the role of women throughout this book, and we're going to come to some individuals in particular in a little while. But on the island, the big struggle in 1878 was, they call it the Great Fire Burn, and it grew into a general strike in 1879. Women were prominent leaders, Queen Mary Thomas, Queen Agnes, there are four or five queens, there's a historical dispute of how many, right? Were the real, very instrumental and big leaders. But Queen Mary Thomas, the main road in the island, is named after her. Here's from the Danish archives. But it's the Great Fire Burn, followed by the General Strike. Harrison's classmate and very good friend, who he stayed in touch with the rest of his life, D. Hamilton Jackson, major figure in island history, led a general strike in 1916. It was one of the things that really caused Denmark to throw up its hands and, you know, be willing to, you know, sell to the U.S. U.S. put some pressure on them, too. But a very important trade union activist and labor leader on the island, and militant labor leader. This is where Harrison was born. This is a state. Concordia plantations were called estates. I was able to go very briefly. When I started this, and for years, Harrison's children never went back to St. Croix. They never went back to St. Croix. They were young when he died. The son was 7, the daughter was 16. Daughter was very bright. She ran while she was still in high school, a weekly column in the Amsterdam News for over a year. That's quite something, you know. But so they didn't have anything. I couldn't get much. I went to Denmark. I went to Washington, D.C., National Archives. I went down the islands. I couldn't put anything together. an archivist wrote in 2001 a book of People with No Memory. What had happened when the United States purchased the Virgin Islands from Denmark, islands were taken, they went back to Copenhagen, they went back to, but they're buried. You know, it was hard to find anything. That's only recently been addressed. They have a thing called the St. Croix African Roots Project. The people got in touch with me right before we went to press. We were able to piece Harrison's family tree together very well. But I also was able to get in touch with people who owned the plantation, Harrison. They're outside France. I went there with some air miles, and we got this. We got a bunch of photos. This is the plantation, 1869. He's born in 1883. Here's the housing that he lived in, right? This is from 1869, a little before he was there, but this is the same housing. And how do I know it's the same? Because here it is. This was actually in January. The date is a little wrong there. But the people still living in that housing today. All right. Here we go now. This is the manager's house, State Concordia. One of the most important, I think, for many things. In St. Croix, there is a policy of promotion, not strict proscription, for a significant sector of the African descended population. Why? Social control needs. You got a class on top. Yeah, they want to be on top, but they can't stay there unless they can maintain control. They've got to do it. Now, in St. Croix, you have 5% European American, 80% black plantation labor, 15% so-called free colored. The Europeans on top, no European working class laboring people to speak of, right? That's the way St. Croix is. So in order to maintain control, they need to utilize the free colors as a buffer, which is what they did in St. Croix. The free colored made up the militia, the equivalent of the slave patrol in the U.S., which was all white. In 1834, there was an edict of full equality, giving equal status with whites for free coloreds. But that status, that's how they tried to maintain control, but as in Haiti, in Saint-Domingue, it was the same situation. When push came to shove in the struggle, that group in between sided with the enslaved because they had much more intimate ties, right? And that's why you had the second enslaved-led emancipation victory. But other differences in how the color line, and this is St. Croix, this is true particularly a lot of the English-speaking Caribbean, no formal segregation, no history of lynch terror. White supremacy was not as virulent or as organized as in the U.S. Don't flip yet. Now, Harrison comments on this. Marcus Garvey comments when he comes. He's an early immigrant. Claude McKay comes from Jamaica, comments on it. McKay's comment is striking. I never encountered such a bitter racial hatred as I did when I came to the U.S. Right? Okay, now this is very brief. We're going to go quick. But I tell you, I write about Theodore W. Allen. I encourage people to look because I got a lot of stuff. But he writes about the contrast in social control systems. I think it has great bearing on the struggles we wage in this country. His two volumes on the invention of the white race, brief précis in this book, and he's got on my webpage, you can click to it, a summary of the argument. It's about 200 points with documented footnotes. He draws a picture, we're in Chicago, as does Lerone Bennett, editor of Ebony and Shaping of Black America, written in 1963, about 17th century Virginia. Most people don't know, the word white doesn't even come into use as we know it until either 1691 or 1680, you know, whatever the earliest account. There were no white people. The status of African, those first 1619, we're back in the 70s, they throw Roots on TV and you see a full-blown system, but it doesn't start like that in this country, right? What happens is, and Allen does, he's got major unpublished manuscripts which we're going to try and get published because he spent 25 years doing primary research in the county records in Virginia looking from an eye of labor. But very briefly, what was going on between 1619 when the first Africans came and certainly 1676, the status was indeterminate. In fact, chattel bond servitude didn't get started. It wasn't here from the beginning. It wasn't people signing indentures. And it was imposed as custom of the country after 1622. Again, this is in these things that are there. And up until 1676, three quarters of the chattel bond servants, people serving 3 to 5 years, 4 to 6 years, were European Americans in Virginia. There was a great common, quickly we'll do this. Bacon's Rebellion, 1676. Between 1660 and 1676, there's 10 bond servant and laboring class rebellions. Bacon's Rebellion, the second Civil War stage in 1676, showed they could no longer maintain control. What happens? The rebel army is European and African American. They fight together. In the end, let's go quickly. Grantham's account, in the end, you have the final holdouts, Europeans and African Americans fighting together, you wouldn't have that for another couple hundred years. In the wake of Bacon's Rebellion, there's a conscious policy of promotion, not promotion out of class, but of extending privileges. Allen details this and that, extending the servitude of African Americans. We develop racial slavery. They change how dissent goes in Virginia early in 1654. Elizabeth Key goes into court and argues she should be free because in England dissent follows the father. She wins. She's half black, half. I know. All right. And a century later, the argument goes to court. They go, no, we can't have that anymore. We'd never have any slavery because you can't prove paternity, and you know everybody would make the claim. So, and they say we'd have no slavery. So they change, and now you have, you know, you follow the condition of your mother. So Grantham's account flipped. Allen argues the white race, this is, we'll just end with this for now, was invented as a ruling class social control formation in response to labor unrest manifested in the Second Civil War stage, system of racial privileges. All right, we can come back to this. All right, we can come back. All right, here's Harrison now. He arrives in New York in 1900. But that's got to do with how the color line is drawn differently in the two places. And we can talk about that. I mean, I'm willing to talk about that. Harrison arrives in 1900 shortly after a race riot. It's the fourth great race riot in New York City's history. August 1900. Black men were seized. They couldn't walk between 28th Street and 42nd Street without being seized. Harper's, still published today, writes, at this time the opportunities of Negroes are less in New York than they have ever been. Meanest tenements, this is where Harrison lived, 60th Street. Harrison lived on 62nd. Monk, Thelonious Monk on 63rd, but it came a little bit later. But it was the worst housing. It was African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, higher price rents, you got less. Largest black community in the city. This is before the IRT gets built, where people take the subway up to Harlem, right? 3,500 people in five blocks. This is the housing on the next block to where Harrison lived. This is improved modern housing. Harrison comes in 1900. This is 1906, it's built. It's improved. It's similar to what was there, but the improvement is this is an interior court. If you had the inside apartment, you had some air. Harrison didn't have that. All right. Employment in New York, story we're familiar with, story people are still familiar with, immigrants are still service occupations, unskilled labor, subsistence wages, 95% of black workers not union. This is what he encounters when he comes to New York. Educational opportunities, last major city to have public high schools, segregation, only to a few hundred black students in schools. All right. Racial segregation throughout, politics, housing, economics, political segregation, segregated black Republican clubs, segregated United Colored Democracy. White party leaders dictated politics to both. Blacks had to be in segregated units. No black elected officials. All right, 1900, the year Harrison arrives, 107 African Americans are lynched. This is four at one time, I believe, in Georgia. Harrison was shocked, as anybody would be, by lynching. He wrote between 1903, when he's working, he's 1903 and 1910, review of books. Brilliant stuff, picked up by outstanding book critics. All right, next one. Okay, what I wanted to emphasize and call your attention, because this is what we're doing here. Harrison, in his first decade in New York, took part in helped make a vibrant intellectual community of black working class New Yorkers. Involved in those circles was Arthur Schomburg, who's from Puerto Rico, who is a clerk. John E. Bruce, one of the two leading black journalists of the day. These are also great independent historians, a messenger. One of the places they met at two places on 53rd Street, St. Benedict the Moor Church and St. Mark's. Harrison refers to it later as the intellectual center of Negro New York, germ of black. The fiercest opposition in debate could not take from the cordiality of personal friendship. They learned to insist on the right to differ and criticize, to dissent, and to do this openly and publicly without beating the devil around the stump. This is the freewheeling, I think this is a good intellectual atmosphere, right? This is how they were nurtured. But this is what Harrison continued for the rest of his life, and not everybody else looked on it that way. Right. George Young is another one. He was active at St. Mark's. Pullman Porter had the biggest collection of books on black history for sale, 8,000 to 12,000 books out of a stall on 135th Street. Charles Burroughs were in Chicago. Their son is one of the founders of DuSable Museum here in Chicago, right? The leading African-American museum in this city and I think in the country. He's a postal worker with Harrison. As it was said, I worked many years in the post office. Harrison writes in his diary, oh, when I finished my dissertation, I did a dissertation while I was doing that postal work, right? And I took his 75-year-old daughter out to B. Smith's restaurant. Anybody know B. Smith? Yeah. All right, good. In New York. And as much as I could spend, you've heard the story. And I took her out, and at the end of the meal, she reaches into her bag and she goes, "Here, Jeff." This is after I had done an 810-page dissertation. She gives me his diary. I didn't even know it existed. But in his diary, that's when I knew for sure I had two volumes. In his diary, Harrison talks about getting off what we call 2 or 3, getting off that night shift in the post office at 3 in the morning, and he and Burroughs, who's another working class intellectual, a postal worker, and 3 or 4 others, and going and holding study groups at 3 in the morning. I mean, I can't say it's crazy. We did stuff like that. All right. Here's his wife, Williana Jones Burroughs. This photo is in the book. The book came out in November. It's now she's getting some attention. It's on the front cover of the Journal of African American History. The same photo now, all of a sudden, just came out, right? And she was a teacher, a unionist. She was also Harrison's first love interest, but she married his best friend, Charles, right? And she's a teacher, but there was a law in New York City. Listen to this. There's a law in New York City that prohibited married women from teaching in the public schools. So when she marries Charles Burroughs in 1909, she's prohibited from teaching till 1926. She's active in the teachers' union. If people are familiar with the union, what the AFT people know today, but there was a left-led union with much struggle, all the different trends in the 30s and stuff. Yeah. Rich History, a radio show in Moscow, right, in English, an English language radio show. White Rose Home, I'm going quickly. Frances Reynolds Kaiser. Briefly, the White Rose Home is the leading black social work agency in New York. Black women coming up from the Caribbean or from the South would come there. They had a place where they could stay safely. If they had children, there was a kindergarten, a place for them to, you know, get child care, they'd get some meals. So people new to the city. And Harrison volunteered, no pay. He did kindergarten classes, he taught courses for the adults, he taught the youngsters. And it was part of what I call in my book, the chapter on getting in full touch with the life of my people in order to write their history. But, you know, he had some projects. But so he was, some people call it organic intellectual, but there's whole subtleties in that definition. This is Frances Reynolds Kaiser, who's running it. She takes it over for a woman named Victoria Earle Matthews, another leading black woman figure of the late 19th, early 20th century. Flipped it. Frances Reynolds Kaiser is the closest confidant of Paul Laurence Dunbar, or a close confidant, because he sends lyrics for A Lowly Life to her before it goes to the publisher. That's a big collection. She is a She's the principal confidant of Harrison. When he breaks from religion, he details it to her in a letter. She subsequently, in 1912, goes down to Daytona, Florida, and with Mary McLeod Bethune, runs that school, you know, for down there in Florida. She is also a civil rights activist. She's a women's suffragist. She president of the Empire State Federation of Women's Clubs, first black woman graduate of Hunter College. She's on a founding committee of the NAACP, executive board. Nobody knows anything about her as Williana Burroughs. I mean, these are people in need of research and projects for the younger people who might be so inspired. Right. Here's Harrison's wife, Irene Louise Horton Harrison. She's from Demerara, region in Guyana, right? People would escape, right? Africans would escape for freedom. Her family came by way of Guyana. And recently, the grandson gave me, he just got some from some relative down in Puerto Rico. They got a whole family tree on that, so we'll put that in the second volume. But she comes from Guyana, Antigua in the islands, and then Puerto Rico, and then to the States. They have 5 children together, 4 girls and 1 son. So Harrison's got a family, too, right, that he's, you know, and these are 3 of the girls. Ada is in the front, the one who I knew later on. All right, this is where the family lived, most densely populated block in Harlem, 231 West 134th Street. He breaks from religion. I'll do this quickly, but he does a lot of serious historical research because he's brought up in the Anglican Church in St. Croix. But he finally concludes, and he documents this, "I am an agnostic, as was Thomas Huxley, and my principle is the same." Huxley coined the word agnosticism. He later calls himself an atheist, too, so, you know, we won't get lost on that. But to Huxley, agnosticism was not a creed, but a method. Basically, it's a scientific method. That's what he is. You know, that's how he's going to approach social problems. Next one. He functions in some interracial organizations in this first decade. Sunrise Club was free thought interest. They'd have speakers. Du Bois would speak. Socialists would speak. Different people, all right? Free thought, if you don't know what it is, thought free of religious dogma. all these things, basically it's a scientific method. There's some books been out in the last few years on it. Harrison on Booker T. Washington. 1910, Booker T. Washington, leading black figure in the United States by virtue of his ties to powerful whites. Pretty conservative philosophy in virtually all areas. Harrison considered him a... T. Washington goes to Europe and in statements in picked up by the press, he's wined and dined in England and in Denmark by royalty in Denmark, and he issues statements that things are fine back home for black people. Lynching, segregation, disfranchisement. Du Bois gets together a group of about 40 people. They write official protests in the press and stuff criticizing that position. Harrison's a postal worker. He writes two letters in New York, Sun, critical of Booker T. Washington, basically saying, Booker T., you can say what you want, but you should tell the truth. Booker T. has Harrison summarily fired from the post office. Now, I told you, he's got, at the time, he and his wife have two children. She's pregnant with a third. This is a devastating blow for a working person, right? And I knew how to get his postal records. He had a clean POD7, a clean postal record, and then he's summarily fired for speaking out. And the person who fired him, by the way, is a fellow named Morgan, anybody from New York. 29th Street and 10th Avenue, that big post office in New York is named after Morgan. That's how you do history, right? His criticism of the NAACP, this is the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. I was just at a meeting the other day, Benjamin Jowett, right? They got the new president, they got a young president, right? We'll see what all that, you know, help me understand what it all means. His criticism of the NAACP, at the founding meeting, of the NAACP, Harrison comments, he sees some early warning danger signs. He says at that founding meeting when they put the press releases out the next day, he says they elided some of the comments of the black participants, you know, some of the more forceful criticisms. And he goes, that's a dangerous sign because we don't want to be creating an organization shaped to white sentiments, right? So, and his early criticisms, he starts articulating is his concern, what is the NAACP going to do if those white minds it's trying to reach don't respond? In other words, they had no proactive policy. That was his concern early. And also, this one is about his comments about limited by white people's conception. All right, next one. He's also, Du Bois is editor of The Crisis, the NAACP's publication. He begins to develop some criticisms of Du Bois. Du Bois, of course, is associated with the talented 10th. Here's the famous quote, the educated and gifted who must be made leaders of thought. Harrison's criticisms early were that they hadn't provided the leadership needed, that they should come down from the Mount Sinai. And he didn't think that colored leadership, which is, relates to within race, color discrimination, you know, and who's considered leadership and background, was preordained to lead. All right, flip. He's in the Socialist Party. He wants to get black people to start breaking from the Republican Party. African Americans have been tied since the Civil War, Reconstruction, the party of Lincoln, Douglas, emancipation. Douglas in 1872 at the Dock Workers Convention, Republican Party is the ship, all else is the sea, right? Harrison wanted to break from that. He appreciated some of the things that Lincoln had done, but he said, we gotta take a closer look because he wanted to start encouraging independent thought. He does this in 1911 and he continues lecturing on this. He does it in articles and lectures where he looks at some of the quotes from Lincoln here where he's really not in favor of interference with slavery. And this last one is used by Harold Cruz in The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, right? It's flipped. Harrison flips it, and we can talk about that. But this is Lincoln. My paramount object is to save the Union, not to either to... A decade ago, Lerone Bennett Jr., senior editor of Ebony, did a book on Lincoln, and it got scuttled, you know, in the press and stuff like that, you know, drawing on some of these same quotes. Not citing Harrison. Didn't know, I don't think. Henry Louis Gates came out within the last year, right, this new book on Lincoln. It's just out, I think, as a matter of fact. Using a lot of the quotes, again, doesn't cite Harrison, but now that one's getting a little better in play in the press, however that works. All right. Socialist Party. He gets fired from the post office. He joins the Socialist Party. Socialist Party is the self-proclaimed party of the working class. 1908, it has 40,000 members, gets 400,000 votes, 3% of the population. By 1912, 6%. Harrison is an active campaigner. Its 1908 platform, anti-monopolies and trust, pro-nationalization of industries, they are only major party to support women's suffrage, graduated income, many things we could still use today, I think. And hold on. All right, okay. Yeah, we can flip. All right. Harrison he exudes hope in socialism. He really is out there pushing it, right? We've got records during 1911, during the 1912 campaign, you can flip, when he campaigns actively for Debs, he is delivering over 20 talks a week. That's morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week. He's a prolific and brilliant. And as I said, he talks on Wall Street, you know, in front of the stock exchange against cap for socialism. He's talking for socialism in front of the stock exchange. All right, flip this. All right, he has now in the Socialist Party, and this is detailed. I detail it very much in the book, but there are lines of differences within the party on what was called the Negro question. Debs was considered one of the best in the Socialist Party. And basically, he's associated with class struggle, with colorless position, no need for separate appeals to reach African Americans. Socialist Party in its first decade, when it started, it had relatively low numbers of women and foreigners. Through the autonomous efforts of women's clubs and foreign language federations, there was a marked increase in the number of women in the party, number of foreigners, and in the militancy of the party, right? This was a plus, right? And there was special appeals, special approaches. Harrison saw that, and he said, let's do the same thing with he wanted to start a colored socialist club. So he advocated special appeals. He also, and I'm going to get into this in, I think, the next slide, he also started articulating very early the duty of everybody in the party, especially whites, to oppose race prejudice, and that he started articulating the position that to champion the cause of African Americans was a revolutionary approach in the United States. As a socialist theoretician, he lays out in his 1911, 12, and 13 writings, things which became staples of much of the left for the remainder of the century, the black left, not the black left, the left, although people don't know it. Many things that are very progressive and were picked up subsequently. The Communist Party around 1928 starts picking up some of these things, 27, 20. Racial oppression, he started to describe as socio-historical, not biological. He proposed a new litmus test for socialists. When Harrison joins the Socialist Party, the big debate is how is socialism going to come, by revolutionary means or evolutionary means? Going to be direct action struggle, mass strike? Is it going to be evolutionary? We're going to elect people to office? We're going to change the laws, right? I grew up in the 70s, you know, there were a bunch of divining things on the, you know. He says, wait a minute, to quote Alan, right? He lays down the gauntlet. He says, Southernism or socialism, what's it going to be for this party? But he appealed to both sides in their own terms. He appeals to the revolutionary and the evolutionary by the logic of their positions, how this was the way they should go. So very deep and very good. He constantly emphasized the duty of all to oppose race prejudice, and he tried to initiate that colored socialist vote. All right. The two factions, all right, that's what I just went through. He also did two things. These are two things that appeal to me. When I saw Harrison up at Schomburg, some of the things that really struck me were these. I got 33 years in the trade union movement. I actively tried, however imperfectly, to get European Americans to struggle against white supremacy and change. At our best, when we were in the post office and the work in the plant, we would come out with newspapers every week. We had rank and file committees. And every issue we looked at how is white supremacy shaping this and what are we going to do about it, right? That was at our best. That's what we did, right? So I have some experience. The two arguments that I have found, but Harrison jumped right on a century ago, two principal arguments that are used amongst European Americans to undermine the struggle against white supremacy are the following. The argument that racism is innate, because if it's innate, why do anything about it? You know, you can't do anything about it. And the second, that white workers benefit, it's somehow in their interest to be racist, right? I mean, of course, the bosses tell you, you know, the ruling class tells you that all the time. All right, so Harrison goes after both of them. The racism is innate argument. He, at one point, he argues that the core of all arguments come down to racism and is innate. We come again. And here he argues against that protected white workers don't gain from race. Who gains? It was the ruling class, and he does an elaborate thing. And that's in the book, which we hope you're going to pick up. And we can come back to this in a little bit. Let's go. All right, in the International Socialist Review, the leading journal, he takes on Rudyard Kipling, the familiar. Rudyard Kipling talks about the white man's burden. Harrison, in an essay, in a poem, talks about the black man's burden, and he basically, his response is, well, let's look at the facts, right?
All we
right.
Need a reprint.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, next one. Then this one, one was before the Socialist Party Convention. This one came out after the Socialist Party Convention. He opens up, the 10 million Negroes of America form a group that is more essentially proletarian than any other American group. This concept, I think, is very important, understanding black labor as proletarian. When Du Bois writes Black Reconstruction, he talks about in the Civil War and Reconstruction, we have the kernel and meaning of the labor movement in this country, right? And Allen, the person who influences me, his last book is towards a revolution in labor history. Flip, we'll get into that. Understanding black laborers as proletarians. I mean, this is basic Marx, propertyless segment of society's ability to produce. If we understand American plantation slavery as capitalist, slaveholders as capitalist, bond laborers were proletarians. This is a discussion we can have, but I just want to get to why I think it's so important. Flip. If one excludes black labor from the proletariat, two things happen. One, we lose some of the most heroic and exemplary examples of working class struggle in this country. And two, it provides a cover for all kinds of class betrayal. It's another one of those rationales for white labor. If we somehow place them, semi-feudal peasantry, I mean, this is again his internationalism, right? 1912, at the Socialist Party convention, they come out, the majority and minority positions, at the bottom, the position that racism is innate at the core. Harrison exposes them on it, nails them, and for the remainder of his life throws that and says, have you come off that position yet? All right, moving quickly. He concludes, Harrison, when he leaves, that the white socialists put the white race first and class after. In that debate on Socialist Party, Victor Berg, all these people talking about a white men's party and all this stuff, and I mean, there's much concrete basis for it. He turns to race consciousness as a protective reaction. This is over a few years, and we'll get into this, as a defense against the white race first, socialist and labor leaders, as a strategic component of struggle for just society. Why no socialism in the United States? Very quickly, Allen, this is in the footnote, Allen takes a look at what he calls the six-pronged rationale explaining the relatively low level of class consciousness in the United States, coming from early left and labor historians. Included in that group are all of these people: Engels, Sword, Eli, Foster, Common, Perlman. The six-pronged rationale, one or more aspects of which they all pick up, are the following. Early right to vote, and there's much more to this analysis. Heterogeneity, freelance safety valve. What Allen argues, what Harrison's going after, is, look, they're more myth than reality, and each one of the six prongs is got to be reassessed in light of white supremacy. But this question of why no socialism, they're hitting at the centrality of white supremacy to understanding that. Harrison, after he leaves the Socialist Party, and while he's leaving, he's constantly moving left, he starts supporting the IWW. People are familiar with the IWW, has good record, you know, integrated locals, integrated meetings, direct action, he defends sabotage, he's very militant, he's the only black speaker at the Patterson struggle with Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood, right? And he gives very militant talks twice, right? Flip. 1914-15, as he's moving away from the Socialist Party, he's talking on free thought, free speech, birth control, the racial aspects of World War I. Francisco Ferrer is a Spanish anarchist educator, develops these modern schools. Flip. At these modern schools where Harrison teaches for 2 years, it's all the current thoughts: anarchism, socialism, syndical, birth control, free love. He's there with all these cutting-edge thoughts. Flip. James Weldon Johnson, active in the NAACP, Negro National Anthem, right? You know, whole history. He's one of the people who encourages Harrison to work in the black community. Harrison turns to concentrated work in the black community by theater reviews of theater and the role that black actors and playwrights play, particularly that black actors play on the stage. And it's not unrelated to the debates today on the images, you know, black images in TV and the movie and everything like that. But that's the kind of mind, again, and he's looking and he starts really getting more clarity on the need for concentrated work and clear on, you know, a race conscious thing and a pride in who we are. All right, Randolph is following him at all his talks. Chandler Owen, and within 2 years they're described as the leading black socialist in the country. Harrison starts developing an understanding that what is needed in the black community is to develop bottom up race unity. He writes conclusion, says, yeah, I had it wrong. Flip. 1916-17 lectures. This is the birth of the new Negro movement. This movement that Harrison's leading in the development of, but many other outstanding activists. It's race conscious, it's internationalist, mass-based, geared to It emphasizes political equality, social justice, civic opportunity, defense, armed self-defense. This is 44 years before Robert F. Williams, Harrison's preaching armed self-defense. All right. You need a biscuit. This was a wonderful piece, Harrison writes. The big advertising campaign, one of the big advertising campaigns in America was the You Need a Biscuit Company, which kept pushing out the message, You Need a Biscuit. And Harrison compared it to the campaign of You Need Democracy, right? I mean, it's fascinating. No, and he goes, you keep telling people that long enough, they're going to pick your word, right? Democracy and promise held out, the war fertilized the race. He talks about how World War I helped develop race consciousness in black people, not only in the U.S., but internationally. Okay. It's a proactive policy of the organizations. It's the mobilizing of black political power, pocketbook, things within Negroes' control, because they couldn't wait around for help and support. If they just couldn't wait around. They're not going to wait around. You know, we're going to take some action. All right. His opposition to white supremacy, he understood it's the key to the class unity. Talks about the principal enemy of the dog of people's capitalist imperialism. And he goes on and he writes a wonderful critique of Foster's The Steel Strike. Foster writes about the Steel Strike of 1919. And Harrison's review talks about William Z. Foster, this is the Communist Party, right, writing about the betrayals by black labor and stuff. He goes, look, until you get clear, you're keeping us out of your unions and stuff, until you get clear on this issue and make it the principal duty of whites, this thing isn't going to go very far, right? All right. Richard B. Moore, another follower of Harrison, socialist, ABB communist orator. This is the first meeting of the Liberty League, the first organization, New Negro Movement. June 12, 1917, Harrison speaks, Chandler Owen speaks, Adam Clayton Powell Sr. Harrison invites Marcus Garvey up to the platform. That's Garvey's first public speech in New York. Marcus Garvey came to the United States as a follower of Booker T. Washington. He was prepared to go back when W.A. Domingo, I'll show you a picture of him in a second, who's from Jamaica, brought Garvey to see Harrison on the street corner, see the appeal, see the message. Garvey decided to stay. Garvey speaks at this meeting. Garvey joins Harrison's organization. Anybody knows anything about Marcus Garvey, he's not one to join anybody else's organization, but he joined Harrison's organization. And so this is the first meeting. Let's go on, let's flip. Garvey joins, all right. The Liberty League was focusing on democracy and equality. It opposed lynching, segregation, disfranchisement, enforcement, 13th, 14th, 15th. This I have to talk about, federal anti-lynching legislation. Harrison and later and William Monroe Trotter are pushing for federal anti-lynching legislation. This is the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. Everybody associates them with anti-lynching work. They refuse to support federal anti-lynching legislation in the first decade of their history. Why? I'm going to show you in a second. But because they didn't want to alienate white support. The same thing Harrison had scoped at the beginning, right? And so they refused to do it. They refused. And why is that important? Well, we see later on with Emmett Till or something like that. You're not going to get any justice in those southern localities as a southern state. Okay, roots of the New Negro Movement. Armed self-defense. All right, flip. East St. Louis, very briefly, this is a big riot, right? A month after Harrison founds the Liberty League. There's a whole background, but just in this photo, a black man in front of the streetcar, whites attacking, National Guard standing by doing nothing. Political voice, that was a demand of Harrison. His papers called The Voice, the demand for a political voice. Hill again says one of the defining characteristics of the New Negro Movement. Harrison emphasized international duty throughout. Here's the tricolor of the Liberty flag. This is a nice little anecdote. Harrison's Liberty League forms a tricolor flag, black, brown, and yellow. Why, he says? Because that's the colors we are domestically and internationally. From this tricolor, Marcus Garvey switches to red, black, and green, which people know as the black liberation colors. Harrison offers some comments on that switch. W.A. Domingo is the man from Jamaica who influences Garvey to come to Harrison's meeting. He's a socialist, becomes first editor of Garvey's Negro World, but also leads in a movement away from Harrison to Garvey. I talk about that in several chapters in the book. We won't go into it here. We can do it in the Q&A. Andy Razaf, people should know him, a great songwriter and a poet, the really first poet of the New Negro Movement. I closed the book with two poems by him, but he's also a songwriter for U.B. Blake and Fats Waller, over 2,000 songs. He writes the lyrics. Great. Brilliant. William Monroe Child, last chapter of the book. 1918, United States is at war. William Monroe Trotter, who's a co-founder of the Niagara Movement, one of the militant older black leaders, and Harrison decide to convene a Liberty Congress to to protest against the war and put forth demands for the black community. It's an autonomous black effort, men and women from 35 states. And I emphasize and women because what gets thrown up in opposition has no women, right? So Trotter and Harrison plan, and this Liberty Congress is going to meet the last week in June of 1918. Here's the Liberty Congress. There's Trotter. There's Harrison. That's the front of the book. They focused in. It was very nice what they did, that person. Joel E. Spingarn. Now, in opposition to what these people are doing, and they're going to put forth demands for federal anti-lynching legislation, Enforcement 13, 14, 15th Amendment. Joel E. Spingarn. Hold on, I don't know. Joel E. Spingarn is a pro-war socialist. We were told the First World War defining line of the socialist movement, pro-war and anti-war, right? And so Spingarn's a pro-war socialist. He's a former Romance language professor at Columbia University. He is the chairman of the NAACP, the head of the NAACP. To this day, the NAACP gives their award, Outstanding Achievement by a Black American, is called the Spingarn Medal, right? He is also a colonel in military intelligence. That is that branch of the War Department that monitors the black and the radical community. If you don't believe me, here he is in his military uniform, right there he is. All right, he is also the closest white friend of W.E.B. Du Bois. Spingarn tries to talk Trotter into calling off the Liberty Congress. Trotter says no, so Spingarn comes up with a counterplan. We're going to hold a, quote, colored editors conference to meet 1 week before in Washington, D.C. More moderate demands. Steal the thunder. No women involved. Moderate newspaper editors and some other figures, but also FDR, non-black people also there. And they convene that time, right? He talks to Du Bois and gets Du Bois to put in an application for a captaincy in military intelligence. Now, the military intelligence is that branch of the War Department that monitors the black and the radical community. Du Bois puts in the application for captaincy. This is all documented. I mean, this is, you know, there's footnote, but I'm not the first, right? But, I mean, this is true. This is what happened. Du Bois, as a matter of fact, writes three autobiographies, two after this. He doesn't even want to talk about this period. It's the period he probably regrets. You know, he doesn't want to talk about. But Du Bois does more than put in for the captaincy. Flip. He writes the editorial he's most embarrassed in his entire life. It comes out in July 1918, close ranks, one paragraph long. So you can see the whole thing. The only thing that I throw in is an explanation, but Harrison did, and Du Bois had explained what special grievances are 3 months before in the crisis, right? And he writes, "Let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances." So Harrison jumps all over him publicly, and he exposes the application for the captaincy, and he says, you cannot be a leader of black people and take that position. Harrison was right. Du Bois would never mention it. Du Bois would never mention Harrison. But I want to say more. What Harrison's doing during World War I and Trotter and black protest during war, Randolph is paying attention, and he picks up. And in World War II, when we have that March on Washington, it's Randolph, you know, is in the lead in some of that. And you have during the Vietnam War, it's Randolph and King, right? So there, okay, let's flip, we'll go. So by the end, this is where the first volume ends. The first volume ends, Harrison, you know, has led all these efforts. Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought. Harrison's a leading voice, although he's only 35, he's recognized. He's led, you know, been a leading black in the Socialist Party, challenged white supremacy, first organization, major black protest leader. He has a bold plan to take his message into the South, the heart of 90% of the black population, heart of reaction. That's where the first volume is going to end. One more flip, I think. So here we have Hubert Harrison, brilliant intellectual, racing class, radical. That's it. Thank you.
Say is, I told you so. All right, so let's have a little discussion. See how much time we have here. How much time? When are we supposed to go till?
I'm here.
We're supposed to go 8 more minutes.
I came to
Chicago.
So we'll
have 17 speakers at 30 seconds each. No, tell you, what I think we should do is we'll go a little over that. If you have to leave, leave.
I'll stay.
Yeah, we know you'll stay. No, but we should, we shouldn't go too far. But let's gather up some comments and questions. Let Jeff respond. maybe do that a couple times back and forth, and then call it a night. Go to the bar, and you can, you know, buy Jeff a drink and hear more. I think it's a good thing that you know, sure, got to do the thing at greater length, because you know, nobody knows about Hubert Harrison. So yeah, thank you for doing that, Jeff. All right, no more time for a plug. So I don't know everybody here, so keep a couple of hands up. Let me just call on people. Okay, go ahead, Scott, and then I'll get Luke.
With socialists, still black socialists particularly, right, in the 1919-20 period, communists, I'm going to go through his whole relationship with the Communist Party, which we can get into here in a little bit, when they try, the communists want Harrison to be their stalking horse against Garvey. He's going to get into Harrison and Garvey, Harrison the communist, Harrison the socialist, a lot of his literary outpourings, his reviews. Most of his writings is in that last decade, so that's the main. It's a major volume.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm really glad I gave this speech. This speech was awesome. Good. And it's kind of funny because as a black male, they don't perceive you as an intellectual. You'd be like, I'd be going to stores like sneaker stores, they're gonna rob something. The trans stores, they're gonna rob something. You go to a bookstore, no one's there. It's like, they're you're not going like, oh, can't read it. What's going to say something? Like, no. So it's like the problem is that, like, with the ruling class, they think it's basically like mostly like us people of color and stuff like that. Too stupid to understand what's like we're passing off for socialism and stuff like that. And we gotta tell them like, look, man, we got people in the streets reading, activism, and we have to put them up there, so, and that's what we should do.
Amen.
Okay, thank you.
Scott and then Kiang. Nate and Kiang.
Yeah, I was just wondering, obviously you talked a little bit about Harrison and the Communist Party later on in Volume 2, but I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit on views on the Russian Revolution,
sure,
because that, you know, 1917, 1918, when I see those dates, I think, what did he talk about?
Yeah.
What were his positions? What were his thoughts?
Yeah, well, later.
Yeah, go ahead.
Very briefly, he's supportive early, and cites the Russian Revolution for, you know, helping Jews, helping, you know, oppressed peoples, right? He goes and speaks several times with Louise Bryant, right, whose husband is John Reed, right, and had been in Soviet Union and stuff like that. So, but from what I can, what I've found so far, there's a limit to how much I can see. I can't say too much more. I know he's spoken, he comments in his diary about it, you know, and he's basically supportive, but there's just a few pieces. I don't have very much. And his publication stops in 1918, he doesn't start until 1919, so there's a little gap in terms of some of the writings.
Right? Kianga, then Al.
Yeah, I had a comment and a question. Comment is, I think it's worth saying something about the Socialist Party itself, because on the one hand, if you talk about, you know, or highlight Harrison saying he's leaving the Socialist Party because he's convinced that white socialists put the white working class first, I think it would be good to sort of go into some of that and actually talk about the nature of the Socialist Party in the U.S. and what was his attitude around the split in the Socialist Party. And just really briefly, because I think it's an important point, because a lot of David Roediger spoke earlier. I wasn't able to go to the session, but even in what I think is a really good book, he raises at one point in the book that, you know, socialists and Marxists have been riddled around this question of anti-racism, around this so-called Negro question, in terms of having a sort of clunky class analysis that sees race as sort of a reduction to class oppression. Negro. But I think it is worth looking more into what the Socialist Party was, that there was a right wing of the Socialist Party,
yeah,
that there was a left wing, the right wing collapsed around the war, as you sort of briefly talked about. They also collapsed around a number of social issues because it was primarily seen as an electoral body that, you know, didn't want to raise prickly issues within the white working class and reduced everything to the lowest common denominator, while there was also a left wing of the party that encompassed radicals, even Debs, who theoretically may have been incorrect, but refused to speak in front of segregated union halls, et cetera, et cetera. And the split in the Socialist Party eventually led to the Communist Party, which did begin to formulate a correct position on the race question. So I think that, you know, I would be curious to know what Harrison's attitude was towards the split Did he join this Communist Party? Did he go with the left wing of the party? I just think the background is important for people to know about the explanation.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Very briefly, I mean, what you say is wonderful, what you're raising. The early things, I go at some length, I think you've got the book too. I do describe the different positions when Harrison enters the party, you know, different positions on the Negro question, the diversity of opinion, some of the history. I don't really, in this first volume, I don't go into what happens later on, but you have to understand this volume was cut down 400 pages. And they have me cutting out, so I kind of had to focus on Harrison a little bit, you know, in terms of not getting into the whole Socialist Communist Party history. But in partly in answer to your question, after he breaks from the Socialists, and he temporarily rejoins for about a month or two in 1918, you know, just to voice his opinions, you know, on a few things, on the war, you know, but he's more supportive of the anti-war position, you know, he supports the anti-war position of the Socialist St. Louis Manifesto, I think, right? And but with the Communists, he does not go. I mean, I'll briefly explain, the Communists try and recruit Harrison, according to the FBI, you know, documents, and you got to take them with a grain of salt sometimes, but there's a few seem to be corroborating things, and I'll talk about this in the second volume. The CP offers Harrison $10,000 to be their this is a lot of money back then, he's in total poverty, to be their quote, stalking horse against Garvey. They want him to be their kind of communist frontman. This is the underground, you know, 1921 around, right? And he refuses, as he had refused money in 1917 when outside people wanted to influence the voice. He maintained some principle in a lot of these things. And I actually, Scott asked also what's coming in the second volume. I mean, in the second volume, I'm going to be bringing in some other things because I did a lot of research over the years, not only in all these continents. And I was mentioning to somebody, I'll go quick, years ago, I was able to go out to the Hoover Institute and stay a month before they sealed the Lovestone papers. So I went through and I copied all these minutes from the early Communist Party. And what I think happened is the money they offered Harrison, I think, and I'm not coming out flat out yet because I want to put everything together, I think wound up in the hands of the African Blood Brotherhood that supported the publication of the Crusader. I think the African Blood Brotherhood was not made by the ABB, but was made by the party. So much for self, you know, right, like that. And what Harrison, his relation with the Communists after that is, he's active with the Farmer Labor Party in 1924. He goes out and speaking, but Lovett Four Whiteman is pretty sloppy with, you know, getting him paid and stuff, and he has to go back. He is the state chairman of New York State of the ANLC in 1925-26. He teaches at the Workers' School, but he really gets blown out on the position at the Lafayette Theater strike, which I can describe briefly, but maybe we'll go on to another question. I'll talk.
Yeah. Okay, I got Al and then Marlene. Okay.
Three things. There was a comment up there that stated something about Harrison saying that race will outlast capitalism.
Oh, no, that wasn't Harrison. That was the Socialist Party. He opposed that position. That was the position that he criticized because it was a racism is innate position. He was viciously critical of it and never let them forget it.
You had two other.
Yeah. What's perplexing me now is how does a man with such accomplishments and so extraordinary, how does he get pushed under the rug? How does he write for the New York Times, for the ISR, and no one knows him? No one. I mean, no one knows.
What's your third question? Who's getting them all?
Third question is, how is he not in the Schomburg Library?
Well, there was a little vertical file in Schomburg, but I can speak a little more on it. Very quickly, right after he dies, Hodge Cannon, who I showed you on the elevator, that fellow from Montserrat, he writes an article in February 1928. Harrison dies in December. He goes, something's wrong here. And he cites The Messenger, which is edited by Randolph, The Crisis, which is edited by Du Bois, and Opportunity, Urban League publication. He goes, wait, Harrison had spoke for all these organizations, done things. He goes, they don't say a word about this guy. Something smells, you know, rotten. And that's part of the great neglect. And but it's not simply in the black community, it's the white. And the academics, and now the scurry, all of a sudden, the offers have come to this, you know, this university and that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they want, people want to hear, which is good, because we're going wherever we can take it. But a lot, it's like I worked in the trade union movement 35 years. People don't take a position on something, you know, it's hard for them all of a sudden to see the light and see this thing that's really important. It's a lot of the younger scholars who are picking, it's this younger generation who's facing war, economic crisis, and this age of Obama, who are really, that's where the hunger is really coming for this. They, you know, they're all over Harrison. They want to...
Marlene.
Yeah, I just want to know if... If Ida B. Wells and Harrison crossed paths, because she also, you know, took on many folks, went toe-to-toe with Booker T. Washington, the boys, and stuff like that. And they did, you know, she was a black woman who was, you know, fighting for anti-lynching legislation. And she went toe-to-toe, and she's also kind of, I mean, there's a resurgence of people, but she's, like, written out of stuff. And they kept, tried to keep her out of the circles, like some of the formations that she tried to push herself into. And just to say that, you know, some of the stuff that sounds like what he was kind of arguing, trying to push for, with the anti-lynching stuff, is very much in line with what she did. You know, she went down there and she did a lot of the, you know, what we see as investigative journalism. I mean, wrote really what was happening to people as they were being lynched in the South and stuff like that. And it was getting in some of
the stuff. So, but that's the only time I know, because they're cities apart, right? You know, and but it was very, you know, very friendly. He writes about it in his diary. What a wonderful time, you know. And you're right about the biographies, because Paula Geer's, a couple of biographies came out recently on Ida B. Wells. Yeah.
David and then Mike. David and then Mike.
Okay, two comments and a question. The first is just that as someone who was a graduate student in history, I just applaud the level of diligence and detail that's involved in putting together a book like that. It's so important that this kind of detailed archival work gets done, and then to have it be done with someone with the political sensibilities that you display is just a tremendous service to our movement, to posterity, and so on. I was lucky enough to hear read a little bit about Harrison, because I took class with Winston James, and actually also been at City College with David Johnson, and looked at him as part of the sort of more as part of like the Pan-Africanist kind of view of things. And you know, my view was always that he sort of stayed in the Socialist Party like as long as one humanly could possibly have done so, given how backward sections of that party were around racism. It was like he fought. You know, he just fought a series of debates with people who were out and out racist, and like, you know, just but seeing that, I thought it was a testament to the fact that to the degree to which socialism has actually attracted some of the best minds in the black radical left. My question about, I have a question about like the formulation of what's meant by sort of race conscious when you formulate it that way. In the context of the Socialist Party and like the New Negro Movement, I can see that as being a very positive thing, but it doesn't have inherent meaning to me in the way that saying someone is class conscious does. And I'm just wondering like what he, if there's specific things that he wrote that give particular content in terms of his particular understanding of racism, of the origins of race ideologically and historically, and just what that sort of means.
He does write, and towards the end, he has a couple of long people. In this book, which is on the back table, he's got a couple of things where he does some of his more socio-historical understandings of race. That's one thing. And on race conscious, he actually has a short essay. I'll see if I can get you a quick paragraph on it. Would you like that? I mean, or basically, it's a self, he describes it as a self-defensive protective measure that's needed, you know, in the face of white supremacy. It's kind of like, you know, understanding your oppression, you're being racially oppressed, right? And uniting and organizing, you know, to counter that. That, I mean, that's at the core of what he's saying. Is that answering your question or not? Good? Okay. And the other comments, and something you said, what you also said earlier, Winston James, and I'm sure you're familiar with his work, but he makes the argument similar to what you're saying, that Harrison didn't fail socialism, you know, what was passing is socialism, right? The socialists failed Harrison, kind of that kind of thing. It's kind of one of his arguments.
Mike here, then you.
I actually passed.
Oh, okay. Very good. You, and then Matt in the back.
So, Jeff, yeah, I applaud your efforts. I met you at the in New York when your book was just coming out.
Okay.
I was thrilled to try to actually.
Speak up a little bit.
Anyway, I'll skip to my point. Do you think this is a teaching moment for black history to see this now included in the American history curriculum in elementary schools? We've got a black president now, and seeing the work that you did now and shining light on
Particularly, I look at the younger people in the audience. I mean, this, you're looking at who knows how long of this economic crisis. And I've got a 19-year-old daughter. I got a 19-year-old daughter, and I just you're up against it. I mean, so you know, and we're at these wars and the age of Obama. It's a whole different ball game, and people are looking for answers, and they want to re-examine things. So I think it's very teachable in that sense. In terms of Harrison, I did a piece in History, I think History News Network or something like that, where I talked about some of those factors and how, with in the case of Harrison, with his material available now. And we've got coming up at the ASALA conference, the Association of Study of African American Life. We've got Winston James is going to be on the panel. We've got Richard B. Moore's daughter. We're going to do the full Harrison slide presentation. People, and then we got a generation of the younger scholars who are coming because they want to pick up on it. And they're going to be the ones who I think are going to take the lead. In terms of the work I've done, a little bit, you know, lunch pail approach. I work, you know, little each day for many years. I get out the basics, but it's going to be people here who are going to really take this and run with it. And I'm very clear on that, you know.
Matt, and then the brother right next to you.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm lucky this is the second time I got to hear you because I also got to hear you speak at that awesome meeting in Harlem. Uh-huh. Which is probably one of the most amazing multiracial socialist meetings I've ever been at. The discussion was just amazing. And I think that, you know, the thing that I'm sort of taking away the second time from is that I think there's a lot of emphasis that you rightly put in your presentation on sort of his role as a critic, his role in, for example, mm-hmm. criticizing the Socialist Party around their bad politics around Asian immigration and racism, around challenging the NAACP for not taking up anti-lynching legislation, challenging Du Bois around the war. But I think the other thing that's really interesting that I really noticed this time is that at every move he was doing it, I think in the way that Dave was sort of alluding to, in every way he was doing it with an aim of actually finding a place where you could actually bring together this fight around socialism mm-hmm. and this fight around racism. And that was sort of what was motivating him. Because, I mean, you actually look, it's true that he didn't take the Communist Party's offer as a sort of a stalking man on Garvey. But at the same time, and he wrote for Garvey's paper, at the same time he eventually breaks with Garvey yep. around two key issues, one being his internationalism. Basically saying, I don't seek an empire in Africa. Right. It's actually the role of the Africans to fight against imperialist yep. Africa that we need to support. And secondly, he says the role of the black in America is to actually challenge the Ku Klux Klan and to challenge yep. rights of
America. Struggle is here. Struggle is here.
What, yeah. And that's what we mm-hmm. need to do here. And so at every step, he's actually sort of looking. And then he works with, like you said, the Farmer Labor Party. He works with the Quakers. He works yep. with the Communist Party to try to find ways at every step to actually challenge the Klan, to actually challenge lynchings and things like that. And so I think the thing that is so dynamic about what Harrison really gave was, although he was a critic of pretty much everybody down the line who maintained that sort of free thought yeah. kind of model and his ability to criticize, he was also at every step looking for the best
right.
place where he could possibly be to organize a struggle
right.
both against class oppression and race.
Yeah, and it wasn't mean-spirited. I think your comments are wonderful, and I'm impressed. You, I mean, you've got a knowledge of Harrison, but yeah, and he's well, he's pressed the hell out of me.
You're
sounds good.
Oh, okay, that was it. So the person next to you, go ahead.
Yeah, really independent, right? Uh-huh. When I was young and I lived in Hoboken, I was active with the Puerto Rican Socialist Party for a while, only because after I had gone to Cuba and a lot of my friends, you know, that's what we were doing, you know, my Puerto Rican friends and I. But that was years ago. You know, I'm still I left because I knew I had to concentrate on work in the U.S. work and stuff like that.
All right, last question, then we'll get a drink.
No, actually, my question was answered. It was just about his relationship to Harvey.
Yeah.
Last words?
No, I just my last words are, I can't thank you all enough. I utterly appreciate this. I'm impressed by the people I've been meeting
get
at the organization.
The book, get it signed yeah. now.
Yeah.
The books are in the back. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Eric.
Scott McLemy is sitting in the front row, and he has done a number of very perceptive reviews on Harrison. And I don't know if you all know who he is, but he's a wonderful book reviewer and journalist, and he's done more than most anybody out there of these reviewers to help get word out on Harrison. So I would just like to...
It has to be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.